Accession number 21050, Reel 4.
Major John Semkin, Tape 2, Site 2.
Well, I got into the way of starting out with the whole squadron in a single field, however small, and then moving out the troops, each troop, so that I knew exactly where everybody was and which way they were facing, so that when they reported anything, you knew what it was. Also, we were no longer on a single regimental net. You see, on any day, you have one squadron in reserve, he'd be on the regimental net. And one of the squadrons would be on the regimental net. The other squadron would be on a separate net. So that you didn't get the clash. Of course, you didn't know what the other squadron was doing, but that didn't matter, because he was often doing quite a different operation and supporting quite a different infantry brigade. And anyway, ultimately the thing developed into the first set battle organized by Monty, you know, with absolutely everything, with huge infantry, a huge artillery barrage and monumental attack. I'm not sure whether they actually had the aircraft, but on a place called Fontenay-le-Pesnil in Normandy. And this battle went on for about 3 days. At the end of the third day, the infantry were played out. And our colonel was told, well, he'd have to go on and take the objectives by himself. And for the first time, we operated as a regiment on a plan devised by our colonel and directed by us. No responsibility for infantry at all. And while we were waiting for this little operation to begin, we had one squadron on the left-hand side. There was a crossroads. We were behind the crossroads. I'd been in reserve, now come up with in front of RHQ, waiting to take part in this operation. We had one squadron on the left and one squadron on the right of the central road. But unfortunately, nobody seemed to be covering the central road. And the first thing that I saw was a tiger come down this road and stop facing me at a distance of about 150 yards. And I looked at him and he looked at me. And I shrieked in my gunner, fire, it's a Hun. And I got a very good operator named Henry Simons, who'd loaded the gun and took off the safety catch, and we fired immediately. And the road was filled with the smoke from the tracer. Couldn't see a damn thing. So we kept on firing. We fired 10 times on this, altering this lay of the gun very, very slightly, until we heard a word that this tank was, they were bailing out. So we said, well, wait, fellas, and let the smoke clear. So the smoke slowly dissipated, and we saw this tiger looking at us. And there's no doubt about it, this was a tiger, not an imaginary tiger like all the tigers that have been reported up to now. This was the SS. And it was a faint trail of smoke coming out of the bloody thing, and its gun was pointing straight at me. And we were in this road, and of course, if there was a round up the spouse and it cooked off, it would have gone through me and through the chap behind and right the way up the line. So we said, look, we've got to get out of here at all costs. So we quietly moved up and crept past this tiger. And then this operation which took place. I forget, one squadron was to go up to a place called the Nicholas Farm, and then a squadron was to take over from there, and we went past the Tiger up the road, debouched onto the fields to the right, spread out, moved up to the first hedge, and sort of 19 tanks all in a row. Well, it wasn't 19 by then, but the remains of 19 tanks. And what we hadn't realized was that the German line was only a few yards in front of us. This is the second time this had happened to me. After we'd been, the next thing was that German tanks began to appear. And we knocked out one of them, and then we knocked out another of them, and another, until we knocked out six German tanks. Well, this is the first time that everybody had ever knocked anything out, as far as we knew, in North Africa, in Europe. And so our tails were well up. The next thing that happened was that we saw handkerchiefs waved sort of in front of our noses. And these fellows, these SS, came out and gave themselves up, and saw a great stream of prisoners. We hadn't known, we'd been firing at sort of a couple of hundred yards away, you see, which was in fact the German back area. And that's why these German tanks had been so silly in the things they did. They thought they hadn't known that we were quite as close. Anyway, the result was that it was rather like Jason's dragon teeth soldiers. These SS men sort of came out of the ground and proceeded to surrender. Some of them didn't. One of them ran up one of my troop leader's tanks, ran up the front with a sort of hand grenade until he shot him. The tremendous guts these fellows had. Anyway, the colonel had the greatest difficulty in getting the infantry to come up even to take the prisoners, but they ultimately arrived and took these chaps away. And that was the end of this battle of Fontenay-le-Pesnil.
Did you have a chance afterwards to examine the Tiger?
Well, we didn't need to, because we, at this area, there'd been a German tank workshops, and we captured a couple intact, which had been abandoned, and they got them going. And I said, well, look here, can I have one of these tanks? Because I'd like to have a tank that I could shove through the hedge, knowing that nothing could penetrate it from the other side. It would be good. And they demurred and said, well, they didn't know there's a good idea about that. Anyway, the result was that the tanks were pinched and sent back to Bovington, I think. Anyway, the ones we captured, which we got photographs of the colonel sitting on it and our chaps driving and that sort of thing. The other rather depressing thing was that we got this tank back into our area with sort of flag on the front and back, and sort of say to indicate that it wasn't in the best of health, you know. And an infantryman came up and looked and said, oh, this is a big tank. What's this, a Sherman? And we thought, oh, God.
In your squadron at that time, did you have the Sherman Firefly, or the upgun version?
Yes, and when we set off, I had a sort of, I think we had four of them. And I had them behind me in reserve, you see. I got the three troops out in front and these chaps behind. And they reckon they got the thick of this artillery barrage. And I had representations saying that this is no good. You know, we're not being employed, and all we're doing is getting the shit. So I said, well, no, look, let's do away with this. We'll parcel them out, one to each troop. So each troop came from three tanks to four, the fourth being this Firefly. And the curious thing about the Firefly was that you found that it was always being commanded by a corporal, because the troop leader wouldn't touch it with a barge pole, and the troop sergeant said, well, he wasn't having it either.
Why? Well, what was their objection to it?
Well, you see, the point of balance of a gun of an 88 in a Tiger is just about, if you look at the length of the thing, it's just about at the point of support. In the case of a Firefly, the point of balance of the gun was about 3 feet in front of the turret. The result was that you had to bolt the turret to prevent it moving that way, and you had to have an iron strap from the breech to the roof to hold it from going that way before you could move the tank. And then the thing stuck out a sort of yard in front of your front. The other thing about it, so that before you could fire the gun, you had to sort of unship it. Well, that was no bloody good to me. I mean, if I'd had a Firefly, I'd be dead, because this Tiger would have just massacred me. But I was able to fire instantly. Fire, bang, you see. Turret unlocked, gun ready to go. Round up the spout, everything. That's a 75. It's a very handy gun.
But when you engaged the Tiger, did you know if your shots penetrated it?
Couldn't see, because it was completely black. In fact, afterwards we discovered that one of these 10 rounds had struck the mantling of the gun and had gone down into the driver's compartment. It was the armor on above the driver's head was relatively thin, and it had gone penetrated there. And the other thing about the 17 pounder was it had a most monumental flash. I mean, you'd have to be terribly careful to see that there were no infantry in front of you or near you when this bloody thing fired. And if you put it through a hedge and fired it, well, there wasn't any hedge. So altogether, it was not a particularly popular weapon. It was very accurate, and gunners thought well of it. I mean, they would amuse themselves by knocking off chimney pots and that sort of thing with it, because it was very accurate. And then on the march, of course, you had to turn the gun completely round and lay it in a rest over the engine, so that everybody in the turret had to turn round and face the other way, you see. And in order to get the thing into action, you have to wind this thing all the way round. Well, I mean, that's not on at all. Wasn't on at all. So the 17-pounder was given to a sort of corporal and said, look, join in when you can. And the other thing is that it's HE round. It's no good at all. Absolutely useless. Whereas the HE round and the 75mm was a marvellous thing. I mean, if you wanted to sort out a farmhouse which is defended by the enemy, I mean, you could put a round through each window, one through the roof, and you could knock the ceiling down. You set the whole place on fire. There was even a trick. You could turn a little gadget on the fuse, and that would give the fuse a very slight delay of a hundredth of a second or something. The result was that if it hit a wall, it would enter the hall before it exploded. So it made a lovely hole. It was you could really have a wonderful time with high explosive from a 75mm, but not from a 17-pounder. And also, it made a hell of a row. It's sort of liable to, burn the eyebrows of the people inside the tank, they told me. They said that the breech didn't shut quite properly or something. You got a flash when the gun... Anyway, it wasn't a comfortable gun to use. Because, I mean, with the 75s, I mean, the tradition anyway, after this battle of Fontenay-le-Pesnil, develop the tradition, whatever you do, you brass up. If you see a German, you fire at him and fire at him and fire, and everybody joins in to fire at him, you see. And the result was that whenever we encountered a German tank, he was always fired at by about four tanks, and which is very discouraging to him, because you'd be surprised as soon as someone is hit, never mind if they're penetrated, they stop shooting. And indeed, one of the great problems on the Battle of Alamein was, where you had a lot of tanks all in a line, was that if one tank was hit and went up in flames, everybody would stop shooting. And it would take quite a while before you could sort of work people up to start shooting. Someone told me that they did an analysis of all the tanks which had been lost in Normandy, and I asked them if they ever checked up to discover how many of these tanks had been knocked out without ever firing a round, because there were some regiments certainly where they had a sort of tradition of conserving ammunition, never open fire prematurely. And I said to one of these chaps, look, when does opening fire cease to be premature? And he didn't really know the answer to that. The answer was after you've been knocked out, like, as far as I could see. The truth is that it is absolutely vital that you should shoot. At the first time you see any sort of target, shoot and shoot and shoot and keep shooting, because it may not do him any damage, but it discourages him, because it takes a brave man to shoot when he's being shot at. And that is true of Germans as it is as anybody else. So anyway, there we are. We were very successful as a squadron. We didn't have very many casualties afterwards in Normandy. I mean, the regiment lost 40 tank commanders in the first 28 days, which out of a tank, 52 tanks, is no sort of a joke. And this is the great problem with tanks. How do you find new tank commanders? Because in the infantry, they're all in it together. I mean, they all know as much as each other knows. It may not be much, but at least they all know it. In a tank, it's quite different. Nobody except the tank commander and possibly the operator knows anything. The driver is probably playing cards on the differential with the co-driver. The gunner is sort of writing home a letter for you to censor, or perhaps is making bully sandwiches, and it's only the commander with his head out who's aware of where he is or where he's going or what the form is. And so how do you then convert one of these chaps into a tank commander? because we imagined in our foolishness that from time to time we would be pulled out of this battle, out of this campaign, and have an opportunity to retrain and reorganize. Never happened. We were from one end of the war to the other. We were always at a few hours' notice. And we never had any opportunity for retraining anybody. We had a continual stream of reinforcements coming in. Fortunately, when regiments were broken up, we would sometimes get a complete troop who would come to us, so intact. But this is that, of course, people weren't all that enthusiastic about taking a strike with a view to ultimately becoming a tank commander, because it's a very dangerous business. If you look at down our list of dead, so far as I can recollect them, I mean, well over 50% were killed by shelling. And they were killed out of their tanks and going to see people, or killed in their tanks because their heads were out.
How did you maintain morale in the squadron in the face of quite severe casualties?
Well, people just sort of stuck it out, you see. It's the sort of fellowship, really, that keeps the thing going. I mean, the only thing that really kept morale going, I suppose, was the thought that we were winning, we were making progress, and that time might come when, we could call it a day for a bit, but it doesn't happen like that. The trouble with this campaigning business is that it goes on and on and on, and it tears the heart out of you. And there are, as I say, the other problem too is this, that as I say, when we set off, you're young, you're fit, you're absolutely convinced that anything that happens to everybody else is not going to happen to you. It's the sort of natural optimism of the human spirit. But I told you I went back on a course from North Africa. Well, when I went, I said, well, next to me, there have been three people who've been bloody lucky. The colonel, second in command of the light squadron, and another chap a pal of mine, but I can't remember his name. Anyway, it took me, as I say, when I ultimately got back to Cairo, I went to our regimental store, which we had in Cairo, where all our glad rags were kept, you see, with an old Sherwood Ranger in charge of it. And then when people got killed, he'd move their kit out to the officer's shop and so on. And he said, oh, yes, sir, they've been in action. He said, four dead, he said, the colonel, the second in command of a squadron, this third chap, and one fourth. And by God, that gives you a shiver. This the thought that what is operating is a sort of law of averages, so that you can actually predict who is going to be killed next. But there we are. I mean, that's the fact is that when you set off in this fighting game, and you've got to understand that it is infinitely slow, and it goes on and on and on with this drip, week after week, month after month. When you set off, as I say, you have this natural optimism to buoy you up. But ultimately, of course, all that you depend upon is your courage. And that, too, is not unlimited. It seeps away until there comes a time when you are actually dangerous, because people will ring you up on the air and say, look, can you get on? And you just don't know. And you say, yes, Wilco, driver advance, and that's it, you see. Because tank fighting is a very highly skilled business. It requires constant attention. What you are doing is playing cowboys and Indians in a caravan. And you have really got to keep track of the battle and to understand what's happening, because the enemy does not wave flags and say, I'm here. It's extremely difficult to read the battlefield, and it takes a long time to learn how to do it, and it requires constant concentration. And it depends, of course, to some extent on the length of the day. When we landed in Normandy, the day was beginning at 3 o'clock in the morning, because we would have to be off and away at 4. And it finished at about midnight, because after dark, it didn't get dark till 10, then we had to pull out of the line, form a Liga, B echelon came, then you got to be refueled and rearmed, and then ultimately, and try to get a bit of food, and then you get to bed, say, about 1 in the morning. And it is extremely exhausting. And during this time, of course, the tank commander spends at least 12 hours a day standing. So it is really very exhausting, and it's very much a young man's game. I don't really think that you're equal to it in middle life. It's no good at all. But of course, all the real chaps really who won the war are these young subalterns coming out of Sandhurst and joining us at the age of 19. And these are the chaps who provided the impetus for the infantry. They're the chaps who provided the impetus for the tank regiments.
How important was regimental identity?
Well, it's the only identity that existed. I mean, it's your squadron that counts, because we didn't really see very much of the other squadrons. occasionally we'd stop fighting for long enough to actually go and invite other people to dinner in your squadron mess or something, but in the main everybody was living on their tanks, feeding on their tanks, sleeping on their tanks, and so on. But it was a very small circle. And I once sort of calculated, what does the regiment mean to any given person? And and it amounts actually to only about perhaps a dozen people. You know, there's always the colonel and the troop leader and the squadron leader and your own crew, and the crew of the other troops, and that's about it, you see. Now, provided those people are intact, okay. But if you were to have, say, 4 of them killed, well, that would be a disaster. Or wounded, of course, or burnt, or anyway evacuated, so that they cease to be there until the new people come. It is quite a small number of people that really mean the regiment to any one man.
Did your soldiers, the officers as well, did they largely come from the Nottinghamshire area?
No. Originally they did, but It started off with the Territorial Regiment, who were all Nottingham people. And also very often closely employees of the officers of the regiment and so on. But as soon as war broke out, they were reinforced to the extent of about 50% by reservists who were taught.